This episode of The Edge is brought to you by Audible.com, your source for the best audiobooks, including unabridged readings of the latest novels from the incredible family of Star Trek authors. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help this show and the network at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
TFM. What have you done out there on the edge of Federation space?
Welcome, everyone, to the first episode of The Edge for Star Trek Discovery Season 3. I'm your host, C. Brian Jones, or Chris, if you like, and I'm excited to explore the 32nd century with you. If you're a longtime listener of The Edge, you know that, in the past, we've had an array of sub-shows. In addition to this main show, we had Live from The Edge, Postcards from The Edge, Tracks from The Edge, and, for Season 1, Notes from The Edge, which I hosted. This season, we're streamlining things, and I'll be bringing you this main show as our coverage of Star Trek Discovery. It will largely follow the format of notes, but I'd love to receive your feedback for postcards, which I will incorporate into this show. For those of you who enjoy Mike and Max's commentary tracks, be sure to subscribe to them over on their website, filmdamagepod.com. where they are doing commentaries for this season as part of their Holodeck Techs podcast. And of course, you can find that podcast in your favorite apps as well. So let's jump right into That Hope Is You. I've broken down my thoughts into four sections: the arrival in 3188, escape from Requiem, journey to Sanctuary, and welcome to Starfleet. I'll also be digging into some key elements of the story in a notes segment later, talking about propulsion tech, temporal wars, and our mysterious alien friend Cosmo.
You have reached year 3188.
When we last saw the Discovery crew, they were on their way to the future, to the 32nd century. And I had mixed feelings about this because I felt that on the one hand, it was an attempt to escape the difficulties of writing stories sandwiched between time periods that had already been fleshed out, while on the other hand, it was an exciting opportunity to tell a new story that takes us beyond what we know. As much as I love filling in the nooks and crannies of the timeline, and I have no problem with prequels, I love Enterprise, I really want to move forward instead of dwelling in the past. The reason for the 930-year jump was pretty contrived, if we're being honest. But that's fine. Let's see where the story takes us. And based on this season premiere, I really like where we're headed. Burnham's arrival in the future was certainly dramatic, and she pops into this chaotic situation in which the Millennium Falcon is fleeing one of Jabba's bounty hunters, seeking to steal its cargo. Or at least that's what it felt like. This sort of action is something that still feels more Star Wars than Star Trek to me, but I know it's what we're going to get in this sort of science fiction storytelling on television in 2020. And at least here, unlike the sequence in Brother at the beginning of last season, it truly does help set up the story. It helps set up Book's character and allows for a first encounter that creates legitimate animosity and distrust between the two characters who we follow throughout the episode. Michael's crash on the planet is intense, for sure, and it raises a lot of questions about this angel suit. But I pretty much just accepted the suit for what it is. Inexplicable tech designed to facilitate a plot late in season two. So I'm just going to go with it. I did enjoy here the process of rebooting the system and hoping it finished before hitting the ground. We've all had that experience of needing to reboot the computer at a time when we really need it to just work. And thankfully for us, it's normally not a life or death situation. as it was for Michael here. But once on the surface, we see Michael do what she promised.
I only wish I could be certain of your safety.
I'll send the last signal. I'll send it to the wormhole when we get to the other side.
I will watch the stars for it.
That was near the end of Such Sweet Sorrow, and here we get this.
Set temporal coordinates for location 5499, section 16, course heading 214, mark 5. Initiate final signal upon closure of spatial rift. Then initiate self-destruct sequence. Activate propulsion. Now!
Sequence initiated.
With that taken care of, we set off to find the ship she ran into, and we meet Book. One of the most interesting bits of their conversation is about wormholes, because right off the bat, we are starting to get hints at what might be going on in the galaxy that has led to a diminished Federation.
The nearest natural wormhole is 100 light years from here. That means you came out of a wormhole you created with tech from I don't know where. You think ripping holes in space is a good idea? Wasn't bad enough for you the Gorn destroyed 2 light years worth of subspace?
I'm going to come back to this a bit later in the notes segment, but there really seems to be something going on in terms of subspace that plays a role in worlds being cut off from one another. Remember, at this point in the episode, we have not yet been told anything about the Burn. I get the feeling that creating artificial wormholes is greatly frowned upon in this century. Book also makes very interesting comments here about propulsion methods and how he now needs more dilithium thanks to Michael crashing into his ship. I'm going to come back to that in depth a bit later also. There are two other points about this opening section, however, that I'd like to make before we move on. And one is about the interface of the control panels. I think it's really interesting. It obviously conveys the idea of the far future, but I got to thinking about it and I wondered, is it really that far away? Honestly, in reality, extrapolating from our own technology today in 2020, I would expect Starfleet to have advanced beyond the touch panels that we saw all the way through Voyager and continue to see on the USS Discovery. Of course, when TNG DS9 Voyager were made, those seemed very futuristic, but today, with all the touch panels we have, I think we need to move beyond that, and controls such as those seen in Picard, for example, Rios's holographic flight controls, seem likely. The thing about the panels we see here is that, based on this first episode, we have no idea how they might work. Burnham looks at them after waving her hand over them and rattles off transmitter, receiver, subspace amplifier. But how does she know, visually? All we see is very cool-looking but abstract mesh silver-blue material that rises and transforms. I do hope we are going to learn more about this, and it isn't just going to be a visual that you are expected to accept and not question, because the concept is really interesting. It does seem that in the 32nd century, pretty much everything along the lines of controls and furniture are formed on an as-needed basis from some sort of basic material that can take the form of anything. And probably, I'm guessing, Space IKEA has the market cornered. The other point, before we move on, is that we also get here Michael's plea for Book to help her. This, I feel, is maybe part of a shift in tone that we might see in her character this season. I've made jokes about the title, That Hope Is You, referring to Michael, because in Discovery, everything comes back to Michael Burnham. And it does. It's right there at the end of the episode. It's actually spoken. But I do want to point out that in this part of the episode, this part of the story, from her perspective, that title also applies to Book. For her, that hope is you, that hope is Book. There's a vulnerability here in the character of Michael Burnham, portrayed brilliantly by Sonequa Martin-Green, I must say, that we don't often see in Burnham. It feels more free of the angst that normally underlies her vulnerable moments. Oh, one more comment here, something that I really loved. We've all been saying for years now, space plus something. And finally, it has made its way into actual Star Trek. Book literally says, that he is space broke. I really love that. Okay, let's move on. This is the escape from Requiem. And so we're moving on to their trip to the settlement of Requiem and the Seedy Mercantile Market, which is that ship thing that's floating above the town. One of the things that really blew me away at this point is the cinematic feel. In an interview with CBS's Matt Weiss, Martin Green talked about this, and she did so more in terms of the special splashy elements, in terms of how they finished the season amid the coronavirus pandemic. And she's talking about visual effects. She said, "When you see the mind-blowing effects of season 3, just imagine it happened remotely from people's homes. That makes no sense to me. That blows my mind," she said. "I believe that season 3 is the most cinematic that we've had thus far. I believe that we've always had that kind of movie feel. We've always been on that grand scale, but I think we go to the next level in season 3. It really is a movie every week with effects that rival blockbuster movies. It's just amazing. It's exhilarating," she says. And I agree with her, but it isn't the special effects that impress me. I'm not surprised that visual effects artists could do this work from home, nor that a team could collaborate effectively while working remotely. I work with the team on creative tasks every day in this way, and the tools that we have today are so powerful and so well integrated. This is what I would expect. What really blows me away are the landscapes and the cinematography. They shot the Requiem scenes in Iceland, which is home to some of the most breathtaking vistas on Earth. And just as our technology for visual effects production has advanced to amazing levels, so has our image capture technology. One addition I was able to make to my home at the start of this year was a 65-inch 4K television with high dynamic range imaging, or HDR. I watch Discovery right now this season via an Apple TV 4K, which, like my television, supports the Dolby Vision format in which this season of Discovery was shot. And what they've delivered in this episode is astonishingly beautiful. If you have a chance to watch on a larger screen in 4K, I really encourage you to do so. You might be like me and tend to consume a lot of content on small phone or tablet screens, even though you have a larger, better option in your living room because maybe it's more convenient or you are on the go. That's what happened to me with the first two seasons of Discovery. I was always on a train or in a cafe, so I watched on iPad. But this is a case where it is worth your time to make an appointment with the big screen if you have that option. Just really, really beautiful cinematography in this episode. Getting back to the story, we soon get into the heart of the matter.
"We believe in ghosts."
"What does that mean?"
"A badge on your shirt. Sometimes you see a guy with one of those badges getting himself all worked up about the Federation. The old days. True believers. Can't handle that it's gone."
This is what I was waiting for. What happened to the Federation? We've been teased by that flag with just 8 stars for so long. Finally, we're finding out, and Burnham says the Federation is gone? That's impossible. Well, not really. That part surprised me a little bit. I know as Star Trek fans, we like to think that the Federation is some sort of accomplishment that will endure forever, just as we think our country of today will endure forever, whatever country that may be. Deep Space Nine shows us how you must fight to maintain what you have built, a point seemingly lost on large swaths of the public who take a passive approach to life these days, and history tells us that empires do not endure. Burnham has jumped almost a millennium. It is not unreasonable to think that the Federation could be gone after that much time, even without a cataclysmic event such as the Burn. And given how intelligent Michael Burnham is and how analytical she is when it comes to science, I was a little bit surprised to hear her say that. But I do think I know how she feels. We don't want to imagine that something like that could go away. Speaking of the Burn, we finally get our first glimpse of what that's all about. Kurtzman explained in an interview in the lead-up to the premiere that what happened to the Federation didn't happen because the Federation collapsed in on itself because of disagreement or strife. That's not what happened. The Federation was as strong as ever. Obviously, something cataclysmic went down that changed everything. Larry Nemechek and I speculated on the most recent episode of The Ready Room what that might be. And here, Book fills us in.
What happened?
Collapsed, I guess. It was a long time ago. After the burn.
What's the burn?
What's the burn? How can you not know this stuff? Seriously, where are you from? I don't want to know.
Please.
The burn was the day the galaxy took a hard left. Dilithium. One day most of it just went boom.
Well, that would do it. At least if we think in terms of the world we know from the 22nd to 24th centuries. Without dilithium, most people aren't going to be able to go anywhere fast. Without the ability to easily scoot around the galaxy, an organization such as the United Federation of Planets isn't going to be viable for very long. Book says this happened 100 to 120 years ago, before he was born, so that would easily be enough time for the Federation to fade. He says that the Federation tried to hang on after the burn, but after a while, they just weren't around anymore. And that makes sense. It is likely that there remained forms of propulsion that could get ships to near light speed, but that is still very slow in dealing with the distances of real space. I love the idea, the premise, but I'm not completely sold on it because dilithium is rare now and traditional warp is difficult. But what about quantum slipstream? How about transwarp? Personal long-range transporters? There's an array of technology out there. So can we really assume that everyone continued to rely on traditional warp all this time? Remember, we're 930 years beyond where we were in Discovery. We're a good, 700 years beyond where we were in the TNG DS9 era, or at least 500 anyway. So if this is true, if that's what they did, then I think the message here is twofold. Don't rest on your laurels and be prepared for resources to run out. And that's a commentary on our own world in terms of limited resources and how our entire way of life can collapse in the blink of an eye if we don't innovate. We're already seeing in the coronavirus pandemic how a sudden disruption to our way of life can truly change the world and really threaten our society. And here we would be talking about something even greater. I mean, imagine if we suddenly could no longer fly jets. It was impossible to fly from one continent to another. What would we do? Our entire modern society would start to break down in terms of shipping and commerce and perhaps in diplomacy. It could have far-reaching effects on us. So maybe that's where we're going here in the story with this little bit of commentary. Another element of this part of the episode is the commentary on the Federation. Michael talks about the ideals of the Federation.
Now, the Federation isn't just about ships and warp drive. It's about a vision and all those who believe in that vision.
That's nice. Do yourself a favor and take off that badge before we get to Requiem.
This part, I feel, is a commentary on ideas such as democracy or on experiments such as the United States, which, in terms of the age of human civilization, really is very young, and it is yet to be seen whether it can endure, and we're seeing the challenges right now. Book tells her to take off the Starfleet badge. In practical terms, it's certainly his way of telling her to avoid trouble. But it is also a statement about how some people would like us to give up our ideals, our beliefs, to avoid displaying the principles for which we stand. I see it as similar to how many people feel that they must stay quiet in social media these days, for example, because to express support for any idea can result in attack. There's a lot of subdued commentary here. The visit to the mercantile itself was a mixed bag for me. I probably enjoyed the conversations between Book and Burnham leading up to it more than the whole action sequence that we get after. The visit serves its purpose of further establishing Book's character and his willingness to betray others to take care of himself. Although, I think that's a cover for his true feelings and intent, because he seems to be someone who wants to help others and bring about harmony in a world that shuns such things. And it lets us see that, at least in some areas, the survival instinct in the post-burn world has strengthened the seedy underbelly of society. I'm also not sure how I feel about yet another drug trip, which seems to be a recurring theme with the Discovery writers. We had the drug trip with Reno and Stamets last season, and now with Burnham. I can tell Sonequa enjoyed playing it, and I think she did a good job, and it was cute for a moment, but I felt like it went on too long. Probably that's realistic. Maybe it would last even longer. But for me, it created a bit of a bump in the story. I'm also not a fan of the Orion and Andorian makeup, or the Tellarite makeup either, to be honest. Enterprise did all these races better than Discovery, and the universe feels more real if you maintain consistency in this area instead of constantly trying to reinvent, although certainly as a creative, I do understand the urge to do that. But it's supposed to be a real world, so let's keep the makeup more consistent. It's already been well established. One other key point here in this visit to the mercantile is the fact that Book needs dilithium. He says that is how couriers are paid, and it helps establish that dilithium has become a sort of currency in the 32nd century, in the post-burn world. In the TNG DS9 Voyager era, it was gold-pressed latinum. Now it appears to be dilithium. They also do a good job here of introducing an important bit of tech that is integral to the story without the need for exposition as we would have gotten in past Star Trek. Michael is impressed by personal transporters, and Book sort of rolls his eyes because for him it is commonplace. Of course, personal transporters have been seen in the Kelvin timeline. Khan uses one in Star Trek Into Darkness to go to Kronos, he sort of uses one. His makes use of this transwarp beaming technology, so maybe it's a little bit different, but the idea that you can just beam yourself somewhere is not entirely new, but it hasn't been a regular part of prime timeline Star Trek. So we needed to know that this technology exists and is likely common during this time period. Otherwise, the chase sequence that follows doesn't work. So I like the way they handled it here because we were just shown it happening. We get one quick comment. We didn't need any long explanations. And then when we see it in use, we think, yep, I got it. It works. Rather than feeling like we had some kind of magical powers suddenly sprung on us. So I really like this little point in the storytelling. That said, I would appreciate more careful editing. Book tells Burnham that the personal transporter takes 30 seconds to recharge. And that comment comes when they're being chased after they've already transported before, and she's wondering why they can't just jump now. The problem is, only 19 seconds passes between their previous two jumps, and then they jump again, and then after that it takes 38 seconds to recharge before they can jump off the cliff. Now, I don't really expect to be shown exactly 30 seconds, and I'm not sitting there with my watch counting the seconds as they go by, but the difference here was enough to be easily noticeable, and it stood out to me right away. If you're going to use a technical factor like this to build suspense, please be consistent. Now, it's likely that an effort was made to be consistent, and the missing time is on the cutting room floor, the victim of editing that didn't consider this detail at the end. But as I said, I noticed it on first viewing, so I'd like to see these little points adhered to a bit more if you're going to try hard to create a realistic world. The extra time at the end is a bit nebulous. Maybe it only took 30 seconds, but it's 38 until we see them actually activate. The setup before that, however, was obviously short. So it's just an observation. It's just something that stood out to me. But anyway, they jump and they make their way back to the ship. And once we're back aboard the ship, we're on our way to the Transwarm Sanctuary. And there's an interesting conversation here between Burnham and Book.
May I ask? You seem to have this connection to things. Plants, transforms. What is it like feeling everything?
Uncomfortable. My family are killers. Poachers. Every so often, one like me shows up in the gene pool. I don't know, something to do with balance, I guess.
So you still see them?
I'm not welcome.
I'm sorry.
But I wouldn't trade who I am for anything.
Book is talking about a specific science fiction situation in which he has connections to nature, but on a broader level, and as commentary on our own world, I take this to describe how so many people feel because they are different from others in their family, from the environment in which they grew up, and as a result, no longer feel welcome. And in many cases, they literally are not welcome, which is the case here with Book. This connects to Discovery's overarching theme of diversity and is likely establishing a theme that we will see running throughout the season. To close out the story, we finally come into contact with what is left of the Federation. And finally, what we saw at the start of the episode with that really cool sequence with the bird alarm clocks, which I suspect will show up on StarTrek.com through CBS marketing sometime soon, and how the furniture rearranges itself, and the man who sits down at the desk with the case with the Starfleet emblem on it. All that starts to make sense now. And I must say that this is an incredibly impactful introduction to the Federation of the far future. The impending performance of Adil Hussein as Aditya Sahil aside, the moment we enter the room and see him sitting at the attendance desk, the passage of time sweeps over us and the feeling of being among, well, as Book said earlier, ghosts, is really strong. It's such a stark environment. It's pristine, as you might expect from Starfleet, but also vacant. Sahil's scan for Discovery reveals some interesting tidbits about what may be going on in the galaxy.
I'm afraid it's not here.
I have two Federation ships in flight at the moment. These are the only Federation ships in a 600 lighter radius.
What about the other sectors?
I only have access to these sectors.
You've been cut off from the other sectors? Entirely?
Long-range sensors failed decades ago. I have not been able to scan beyond 30 sectors since then. I would imagine it is the same for all others.
As I mentioned earlier, Kurtzman said in an interview that the Federation was as strong as ever and that what brought it down was beyond its control. Book's explanation that most of the galaxy's dilithium exploded in the event now known as the Burn explains why planets have been isolated from one another and why travel over great distances is now difficult and seemingly uncommon. but Sahil's revelation adds more intrigue to the situation. It seems that one of the effects of the burn was to isolate areas of space in a way that makes communication itself difficult or limited. Book mentioned that the Gorn destroyed 2 light-years worth of subspace, but gave no other details about why, when, or how. Given that subspace communication has long been a staple of Star Trek, and that's how Starfleet and the worlds of the Federation communicate, might it be that damage to subspace resulted from the burn, and this has limited the range of scanners and communication? And now, as we get near the end of the episode, we come to the most touching moment.
Commander Burnham, now I'll tell you a secret. I'm not a commissioned officer. You see, my father was. His father before him. But unlike them, I was never officially sworn in. There has been no one to do it. Yet, I watch this office every day, as I have for 40 years, believing one day others like me would walk through that door, that my hope was not in vain. Today is that day, and that hope is you, Commander Burnham.
The performance of Hussein in this scene is beautiful. The solemn tone, with sparks of optimism popping through at just the right moment, really conveyed for me the spirit of what the Federation is, what Starfleet is, what Gene Roddenberry's vision is, and how it endures, even if challenged and weakened across time. And his response when Burnham asks if he will accept the commission of acting communications chief, unspoken and holding back a tear, was the most touching moment of the episode. I can't imagine a better performance to embody what Star Trek means to me. Rewinding just a hair before this moment, Sahil says, "I do not know how much of the Federation still exists. I simply do my part to keep it alive." And I think this is how so many of us feel in the world today. Whether or not this season of Star Trek Discovery is a commentary on the deterioration of our own world that is taking place around us is debatable. The theme is one that repeats itself throughout history. But we are certainly at an inflection point right now. Most of us feel helpless, hopeless, I think, but we try to maintain hope that things will get better, and that those ideals in which we believe are still alive somewhere in some people.
Hope is a powerful thing.
Sometimes it's the only thing.
Our numbers are few. Our spirit is undiminished.
So those are my thoughts on the story, but there's one more thing. This was part one, you say? The last thing I'll mention before diving into notes is the title. I think we were all a bit surprised to see that part one tacked on there. We knew that the first episode was entitled That Hope Is You, and that the second episode is listed as Far From Home. So what's going on? It's a bit odd for sure. It is possible that there's a surprise installment coming between this one and Far From Home, added at the last minute. Might That Hope Is You have originally been a 2-hour episode and it has been split into two? So the second part will be inserted into the list we know? I kind of doubt that. The ending sure feels like proper closure to a single installment. Some other speculation that I've seen is that Far From Home simply is That Hope Is You Part 2, but with a different name. Deep Space Nine did this sort of thing often, even before the heavy serialization of the later seasons, but they didn't add part one to a title. I don't think this is it either, and really, Discovery seasons are just one long story anyway. I've also seen speculation that That Hope Is You Part 2 will be the season finale. I think that's possible if they tack on a 14th episode. Right now, the finale is listed as Outside. And some people have also suggested that it will be the first episode of season 4. Maybe. It's possible. I find that to be a bit of a creative stretch, though, but yeah, it could be. We'll see. Or then again, maybe there won't be a part 2. Maybe it's lost to time, a victim of the temporal wars. All right, I'm going to make my notes segment, which some of you know from season 1, part of this incarnation of The Edge. This is where I deep dive into how Discovery connects with the broader Star Trek universe. There were a lot of things to choose from in That Hope Is You, and we'll look at 5 items. The Temporal Wars, Quantum Slipstream Drive, Tachyon Solar Cells, Trilithium, and Betelgeuseans. Let's start with that last one, which was a late addition to my prep for this podcast. The alien who we see pursuing Book near the beginning of the episode is named Cosmo Trait, and his race is unclear, to be sure. At first, I thought that he might be a Reeman, but that didn't really make sense to me, and given the makeup and his interest in Book's cargo, I thought it likely that he was a Eurydian, and the makeup had been updated a little bit for Discovery. We've seen plenty of Eurydians over the years, starting with Birthright, when Jaglom Shrek tells Worf that he knows the whereabouts of Worf's father, Moog. That episode aired in February 1993, and after that, the Eurydians appeared 28 more times in The Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and Enterprise. So it would have made sense to bring them back here. But apparently, that's not what happened. According to the Discovery After Show, Cosmo is a Betelgeusean, a race seen only once before in Star Trek The Motion Picture in 1979. I'm not sure there are many Star Trek fans, certainly not those who grew up with Voyager and later, a large percentage of today's fan base, who have any idea that this race exists. On the one hand, it's really nice that they are digging deep to bring back and flesh out obscure races. On the other hand, I'd prefer that they not change the makeup so much, particularly when the shift moves so close to a known race that makes more sense for the story. If you want to catch a glimpse of Betelgeuseans, turn on the motion picture and scan to the scene in which Kirk arrives at the Starfleet headquarters transport terminal. There are 3 Betelgeusean ambassadors standing nearby. Later in the film, when Kirk briefs the Enterprise crew in the recreation room about the V'ger situation, a Betelgeusean can be seen in the crowd as a member of the crew. That's it. I should mention, of course, that despite barely being seen in the film, the Betelgeuseans did make their way into a lot of the toys that accompanied the motion picture's marketing push, thanks to their unusual look. The Betelgeuseans were a bigger hit in the litverse, I'd say, appearing in 6 stories and being referenced in 2 others. Their first reference was in 2001 in T.G. Theodore's short story, A Little More Action, from the Strange New Worlds 4 anthology. And their first appearance was in 2005 in Christopher L. Bennett's original series novel Ex Machina. And that might start a theme for us. Bennett seems to really love the Betelgeuseans, as he is responsible for all but one of the references and one of the appearances. He used them again in his Titan novels Orion's Hounds in 2006 and Over a Torrent Sea in 2009. That same year, James Swallow put a Betelgeusean tactical officer in his Titan novel Synthesis, an ensign named Ku-Yut. Then Bennett continued the streak in his 2011 Department of Temporal Investigations novel, Watching the Clock, and his 2016 TOS novel, The Face of the Unknown, and he also references them in another DIT novel, 2011's Forgotten History, and a 2008 short story entitled Places of Exile, which is part of the Myriad Universes Infinity's Prism collection. I wonder if we'll see more Betelgeuseans this season. because Cosmo himself is toast. Well, that's enough about the surprise alien. I just got really curious when I saw him on the screen, and I spent the whole episode trying to figure out what race he might be. But let's turn our attention to propulsion. Book rambles off a list of ways to travel fast when he and Burnham first board his ship. And these include quantum slipstream drive, tachyon solar cells, and trilithium. So let's start with quantum slipstream drive. First seen in the Season 4 Voyager episode Hope and Fear, quantum slipstream technology allows a starship to travel faster than light without the use of antimatter. Voyager encountered the USS Dauntless in 2374, and it appeared as if the ship's quantum slipstream drive might be their ticket home.
They call this thing a quantum slipstream drive.
Quantum slipstream. I've never seen that in the engineering manuals.
Captain's log, supplemental. After 2 days at high warp, we've rendezvoused with the Dauntless. Arcturus has helped us reconstruct most of the Starfleet message. The pieces of this puzzle are finally coming together.
Slipstream technology is experimental and high risk, but it's come a long way in the past year. We've conducted 47 trial runs, all of them successful, but each flight lasted only 5 days. In order to reach Earth, you'd have to remain at slipstream velocity for a full 3 months. Can your crew survive that long? We believe they can, and we encourage you to try. Everything you'll need is on the Dauntless. Power cells, supplies, living quarters. Safe journey. We hope to see you soon.
The Dauntless could cover 60,000 light years in just 3 months. As an aside, that ship, by the way, had the curious registry number of NX-01A. The episode aired on May 20th, 1998, and predates Star Trek Enterprise by 3.5 years. Of course, the USS Dauntless was not really a Federation starship. It was created by Species 116, but the propulsion technology was real, although not within the capabilities of Starfleet. The alien Arcturus, who made his own ship appear to be a Federation starship, based the appearance on Starfleet prototypes for a Dauntless-class starship, and it does seem that such a ship came to be later on the timeline. During the Battle of Procyon V, a 26th century conflict shown in the third season Enterprise episode Azadi Prime, a Dauntless-class ship can be seen in the fight. As a side note, the Battle of Procyon V is interesting in connection with what may have occurred during the years between the latest events we've seen on the timeline, Season 1 of Star Trek Picard, which takes place in 2399, and where Burnham is now in 3188. I'll come back to this later so as not to get too far off topic here. And I also should just mention, when I talk about the timeline, I'm talking about what we've seen on the screen right here. I know that Star Trek Online progressed beyond this, but I'm talking about on-screen Star Trek. So anyway, going back to quantum slipstream, we may actually be seeing it in action in this episode. As Book and Burnham make their way to Sanctuary 4, it's unclear how they are traveling. The visual effect suggests it is not normal warp. Book said earlier that he needed more dilithium so that he could finish his run, and they did get more dilithium from the mercantile. Although I'm not sure that you should just be picking up raw dilithium with your bare hands and sticking it in your pockets. But that's a topic for some other time. The trip to the sanctuary is likely the last stretch of that run he was talking about, so maybe this is warp. But when we have seen normal warp on Discovery in the past, it has been depicted with a circular form that, while not entirely dissimilar to what we see here, is clearly different from this flat plane that Book's ship is traversing. But given that quantum slipstream is much faster than traditional warp, I'm not sure why Book would choose to use dilithium and warp around at those speeds if he has access to this method. Anyway, we'll find out more as the story goes on, no doubt. I think that how people get around in the 32nd century is going to be a very important part of the season. Now, as we always do on Notes from the Edge, let's delve more deeply into how this connects to the broader Star Trek universe. I've already said that the first appearance of quantum slipstream drive was in the Voyager episode Hope and Fear, which was the season 4 finale, and we see it come around again early in season 5 in Timeless when Janeway unveils a slipstream drive that the crew has designed using some of the information they gained from Arteris's fake vessel.
Ladies and gentlemen, please. May I introduce the next generation of interstellar propulsion, the quantum slipstream drive. 4 years, 2 months, 11 days. That's precisely how long Voyager's been in the Delta Quadrant. During that time, we've advanced the frontiers of exploration, and more importantly, we've survived. Now it's time to go home. Enjoy the celebration, but keep in mind, we still got a lot of work to do before tomorrow's flight. Go easy on that champagne, Lieutenant. Quantum matrix, benamite crystals, Borg technology. Can you imagine what Starfleet is going to say?
I don't think we'll hear any complaints. The Federation's first slipstream drive. They'll probably nominate us for the Cochrane Medal of Honor.
I'll start working on my acceptance speech.
Unfortunately, it doesn't work as planned. They can't get all the way home, but it still cuts about 10 years off their journey. Of course, a lot of other stuff happens in between in that episode, and the slipstream drive is sort of the impetus for the real story in Timeless. But nevertheless, the technology is a part of that, and it does exist. Timeless is also the episode in which we first hear about benamite, a type of crystal that Book mentions in this episode. Whereas dilithium is the key power source for traditional warp engines, benamite is the same for quantum slipstream drives, which, by the way, means that it is less likely that we are looking at quantum slipstream as they make their way to Sanctuary 4, because looping back to my earlier comments, Book did tell Burnham that he doesn't have any benamite. No one does, he says. So it would seem that slipstreaming his way to the Sanctuary is probably not an option. Anyway, we hear about quantum slipstream one more time on screen prior to Discovery in the Voyager Season 5 episode Think Tank, in which George Costanza, Kuros, lists it as one of the things he'd like as payment in return for helping Janeway formulate a plan to escape from the Hazari. In the Litverse, quantum slipstream drive turns up in Christopher L. Bennett's 2008 Star Trek The Next Generation novel Greater Than the Sum, Keith DeCandido's 2009 novel A Singular Destiny, Kirsten Beyer's 2009 Voyager novels Full Circle and Unworthy, David Mack's 2010 Typhon Pack novel Zero Sum Game, David R. George III's 2012 Typhon Pack novels Plagues of Night and Raise the Dawn, as well as his Deep Space Nine novel Sacraments of Fire, which was published in 2015. And without spoiling stories, sort of the thread through here is, let's just say that quantum slipstream becomes an important part of Starfleet's post-Borg activities beginning in the late 24th century. Captain Ezri Dax's ship, the USS Aventine, was one of the first Starfleet ships equipped with the technology, and the ships of the Full Circle fleet, led by the USS Voyager, of Kirsten Beyer's novels, are also equipped with these drives. So, by the 32nd century, quantum slipstream is probably as commonplace as traditional warp, but maybe, as is the case with dilithium, maybe getting your hands on benamite is not so easy. Another propulsion method that Book mentions is the use of tachyon solar cells. This seems to be a reference to the third season Deep Space Nine episode Explorers, in which Sisko builds an ancient Bajoran lightship to prove that Bajorans could have reached Cardassia as many as 800 years earlier without having the type of warp drive commonly in use during the 24th century. The ship was pushed forward by photons from the Bajoran sun, and it wasn't designed to travel at warp, that was just a side effect, so Book's mention of it here does feel like an homage rather than some sort of practical method of travel in common use. He does mention that it is slow as shit. Explorers isn't the only appearance of the Bajoran solar sail ship, however. We see it again in the fourth season DS9 episode, Accession, when Akoram Lan, the 300-year-old Bajoran poet who claims to be the emissary, arrives in one. Other on-screen appearances of solar sails, although not really in the same sense, are in Star Trek IV The Voyage Home and Star Trek Insurrection. In the Litverse, solar sails appear or are mentioned in Diane Carey's 1988 TNG novel Ghost Ship, which, by the way, was the very first of the numbered TNG novels, Peter David's 2004 New Frontier novel After the Fall, and Greg Cox's 2012 TOS novel The Rings of Time. One more thing Book says is, don't even get me started on trilithium. On the surface, this might seem like a misunderstanding on the part of the writers. On screen, each time we've heard about trilithium, it was connected to some sort of weapon. The first time that most people remember was in the film Generations. Sorin uses trilithium to collapse stars and guide the path of the Nexus Ribbon. But actually, it was mentioned once before that in the sixth season TNG episode Starship Mine. In that story, terrorists board the Enterprise-D to steal trilithium resin that is being cleaned from the ship. During Voyager's third season, Harry Kim and Tom Paris are accused of using trilithium to bomb the Lactivia recreational facility on Akrotiri and thrown into prison in the episode The Chute. And in the fifth season DS9 episode For the Uniform, Sisko uses a trilithium weapon on a Maquis colony during his standoff with Eddington.
Prepare two quantum torpedoes. Have engineering attach a cargo pod with 200 kilograms of trilithium to each torpedo.
Yes, sir, but...
But what?
The extra mass of the cargo pod will make the torpedo less effective. Maquis raiders are small and maneuverable.
I'm not planning to fire at any ships, Mr. Worf. Major, what's the nearest Maquis colony?
Shortly after this, in the episode By Inferno's Light, there is concern that a changeling has placed a trilithium device aboard the runabout Yukon as part of a plan to destroy the Bajoran sun, a clearer callback to Sorin's technique seen in Generations. And at the start of Season 7, there's another mention of trilithium in Image in the Sand. Detection of the compound is how Kira comes to believe that the Romulans have placed weapons on a Bajoran moon where they've supposedly, anyway, set up a medical facility. There's also a mention of trilithium in the fifth season Voyager episode Course Oblivion. So, okay, this was basically just a long-winded way for me to get to this. In the Litverse, trilithium moves beyond weapons use and into the realm of propulsion as part of efforts to develop transwarp drive. Although to say that it moves beyond is maybe the wrong way around, actually, because the first appearance of trilithium goes all the way back to 1986 and Diane Carey's novel, Battle Stations! And yeah, there's an exclamation mark at the end of that title. In that book, there's research going on to try to find a process for the extreme refinement of dilithium into trilithium. And Spock explains that trilithium existed only theoretically until 4 years ago. The story takes place in 2270, and that it is the compound that allows the advanced flow of energy to be compacted into transwarp drive. So that's where we get into a bit of the propulsion element of trilithium, and then how it can connect back to transwarp drive. Of course, the other and more recent, most recent, actually mention of trilithium in the Litverse takes the form of a weapon again. This is in Judith and Garfield Reeve Stevens's 2009 DS9 novel, The War of the Prophets, which is the second book in the three-part Millennium series. And in that story, Starfleet outlines a stunning time travel plan involving trilithium-based deep time charges, as they're called. And this is a weapon that they intend to plant on Bajor 25,000 years in the past to destroy a threat called the Ascendancy. And I'll leave things vague so that you can go read the books. But Yeah. Based on what we've seen on screen, what most people know about trilithium, books mention of it here in a list of things to be used for powering his ship. It does seem a bit odd. Lastly, the entire setup for this season, moving Discovery to the 32nd century, hinges on time travel. Book makes an interesting passing comment when talking to Burnham about how she got to this point on the timeline.
True believer.
Yeah.
Time traveler.
Yeah.
I figured. Don't know how you came by whatever you used to get here. All time travel technology was destroyed after the Temporal Wars. Outlawed.
As someone who loves time travel stories and has generally been fascinated with the concept of time since I was a kid, this bit really interests me, but I'm not sure it makes sense. I suppose you could destroy all time travel technology in your time frame, but you cannot control the past or the future. It seems like one of those lines that sounds good, one of those ideas that sounds good, but doesn't fit together if you think about it for 2 seconds. But Star Trek has a long history of playing with these ideas, and of course, Book's comments made me think about the temporal Cold War plot found in Enterprise. The Battle of Procyon V, which I mentioned earlier, was part of the fight between the Federation and the Sphere Builders, whose attempts to transform space had progressed drastically by the 26th century. During the 400-plus years since the NX-01 encountered the first anomaly in the Delphic Expanse, the transdimensional incursions had grown from 700 million kilometers to 50,000 light years. It's sort of an aside to actual time travel, but the Sphere Builders had the ability to examine various timelines and had agents native to our dimension carrying out time travel missions on their behalf. Will there be a hookup between the temporal Cold War of Enterprise and the temporal wars that Book mentioned? Probably not, but I imagine that both involved actions that damaged subspace, and that idea seems to be important to this story. It isn't clear if Book, when he says temporal wars, is referring to this conflict from Enterprise, which we could say became a hot war when Nakul from the 29th century fled to 1944 Earth and attempted to change the course of history by intervening in World War II, but this could very well be the case. I'm not even sure if the temporal wars should be capitalized. This is the sort of thing that I worry about as an editor. Is he talking about one conflict, in which case it would be? Or is it a series of wars, just sort of collectively over time, there were various temporal wars? I would hope that the writers would leverage an existing storyline, especially one that spans 7 centuries, rather than make up something completely new, but we'll see. Or maybe we won't. This could have just been a passing comment. As for the Nakul, they were picked up again in the Litverse by Christopher L. Bennett in his 2011 Department of Temporal Investigations novel, Watching the Clock, and also Dayton Ward references them in his 2013 TOS novel, From History's Shadow. All right, well, that's my long rundown of the first episode of Star Trek Discovery Season 3, That Hope Is You, Part 1. I hope you enjoyed the ramblings and would love to hear your thoughts on the episode. As I mentioned at the beginning, I'll incorporate postcards into this show, so please share your thoughts and questions. Here are 3 ways you can do that. Go to the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook, and add your thoughts, comments, and questions to the post for this episode of The Edge. Or send email using the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and choose The Edge, and that will come straight to me. Or hit me up on Twitter. You can tweet to the network account if you like. That's at @trekfm. Or tweet to me personally at C. Brian Jones, the letter C, and Brian with a Y. That's my username pretty much everywhere, but Twitter is where I'm most active. And I'm always up for thoughtful discussion of Star Trek, be it Discovery or any series. So feel free to hit me up at C. Brian Jones. If you'd like to hear more of my thoughts on Star Trek at large, you can find me on my main show, The Ready Room, which I do with Larry Nemechek. Been doing that show for 10 years now. And you can also find me on The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast that I do with Matthew Rushing. And Matthew and I also host Literary Treks. That's our books and comics podcast. Not only can you explore the Litverse through that show, and you know I talk a lot about the Litverse here on this one, you can also hear firsthand from the authors, as we have the great pleasure of talking to almost all the active Star Trek authors as their new novels are released for a behind-the-scenes look at the writing process. I also have a new Star Trek Universe podcast called Interphase, and I'm exploring all corners of the franchise through that show. I have several episodes of that out already with varying topics, so please check that out. And you can find these and all of our Trek FM podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and pretty much everywhere you get your podcasts. Just search for Trek.fm or the name of the show, and you should find it there. Lastly, if you'd like to help us keep The Edge and all of the shows on our network going, we could definitely use your help. The coronavirus pandemic has taken its toll on us, as so many people have understandably had to reallocate resources. And it takes a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows, and any support you can provide is most appreciated. If you'd like to help, please visit patreon.com to find out how. We have various perks, including the ability to become an associate producer of your favorite shows and to get involved in the Patrons Roundtable, where you can hop on mic with fellow listeners and some of our hosts to discuss Star Trek just as we do on our podcasts. And we publish that on our website and in our master feed for everyone to hear. It's a great path for becoming more involved in the network. So check out patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, to find out how you can help. And I'd like to thank our associate producers of The Edge, James Muldrow and Cornelia Rutner, and I hope others will come aboard to help us keep Star Trek discussion alive. And a big thank you to all our patrons for your support. We really could not do this without you. All right, well, I look forward to your comments about the first episode of Star Trek Discovery, so we can slip some postcards into the show here, and it's time to start preparing for the next installment of Discovery's 32nd Century Adventure. So enjoy the week, I'll see you in the Babel Conference and elsewhere, and I'll also see you next time as we rebuild the Federation.